A friend of mine who was in the advertising world got a plum of a job working for IKEA when IKEA was first coming to the United States and setting up its first store in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And he actually, because then American advertising was going to be so crucial to the company, he was going to have a meeting with Comprod, the multi-billionaire, possibly richest man in the world at the time of his recent death. Comprod was going to be meeting with him, the founder of IKEA. And the man said to one of Comprod's subordinates, "Well, any advice for me?" He said, "Comprod is actually, he's very open. He likes the United States. You know, any ideas you have, he'll be open. But there is one thing you are not allowed to talk about, and that is you are not to say, you know, it's kind of complicated putting IKEA things together. There are ways you could actually make it simpler. You say that, and he will bodily throw you out of his office. Don't you dare say that." Now, as one who's put together my share of IKEA, needing marriage counseling after when my wife and I did it together, I'm sure there are simpler ways. But why did Comprod not want to hear it? Because he said that was added value. He said the furniture we're making is not such precious stuff by any means, and we're always finding ways to make it cheaper to produce, including hiring prisoners in Poland and things like that. You know, you name it, this man did it. But people put it together themselves. It's tricky. The directions are not 100% clear, and it means something to them. I did that. I put that together. You know, the Betty Crocker sort of approach. If you just tell people to add water, they don't care about using Betty Crocker. But if it's water and an egg, I made that. I baked that myself. So he found just the right formula. He doesn't want to make it any simpler. He certainly can't make it any more complicated. And I'd say that this is one of the keys to the Waldorf curriculum. It is very much do it yourself. Now, certainly one can walk into Waldorf schools and see a beautiful chart done by David Mitchell many years ago, the Waldorf curriculum all laid out. Or at Rudolf Steiner College, they would have teacher trainees make funny little charts with gnomes and things like that. The Waldorf castle or the Waldorf labyrinth, the Waldorf whatever. It's all very sweet, but the reality is Steiner gave a lot of faint clues and indications, as Walt Whitman would say, many things that he gave once and not again, and that he left teachers to their own devices, and people found what worked, and people also introduced things along the way while Steiner was still alive, which he would approve of or disapprove of, which have become part of the canon. And then after his death as well, and much more of the sort of thing where you're told by a mentor in a Waldorf setting, Rudolf Steiner said you, generally those are things he told people after he died, I think, because we have no record of it ever being said in his lifetime. And he contradicted himself and did many things very, very differently. And he was busy at this time, busy, still working with the threefold social order, still meeting with factory workers. It was, in fact, the meeting that he had where he finally said yes to Emil Malte, "I will help you start a school." This was right after he met with several thousand employees at the Daimler plant, at the Mercedes automobile manufacturing company. So he was in the middle of many, many things, and all of that we have from him is in movement. It's incomplete. It's waiting for the teachers to find their own way of putting it together out of their sense of the child, out of their relationship to the child. What he gives us is anthroposophy, to understand child development, but also to find a way to relate to our children on more than one level. So, okay, I'm a first grade teacher. I have a fairy tale that I'm going to tell the children. The king, however, was not a good man. He had a bad heart. And when he heard the prophecy that this boy was going to be king, he thought, this is not good for me. And so he said to the parents, I will give you gold, much, much gold, if I can take the boy back to my castle, and there I will treat him like my own son. Well, when the parents heard this, of course, they wanted the gold, and even though they would miss their son, to think of him as being brought up by the king, this would mean so much. So the king took him away. But instead of making him his son, he found a barrel, and there he took... He took the barrel, and he threw it in the stream. He threw it in the stream, and there the whale. You see the wheels turning. I sit in the back of classrooms and watch teachers working. Now, of course, I'm sitting there. You know, I wouldn't want to be. Have me sitting in back of my class either, you know, doing this and things like that. I mean, terrible. What nerve. But what's going on there? The etheric body is working. The etheric body holds the memory of that story, okay? And suddenly one loses access to the etheric. Why? Because there's a child there who's doing something perhaps slightly naughty, or who's not paying attention. And you go out, you sort of want to reach that child, make eye contact or whatever. Well, that takes your astral body, and the astral body now supplants the etheric body. So you're with the child, but you've lost the story. And or you're doing both things well, you've got the class discipline, and suddenly you realize this story of a parent who deceives their child is actually the story that this boy needs to hear. He's gone through something like this with his father as well, who's always making promises, never fulfilling them. Oh my gosh, I can see a kind of light going in this child's head. And it's as though this comforts him that he's not the only person to whom this has ever happened. He couldn't put that into words, but it's there. Well, that interrupts not only my telling the story, those wheels, but also my linear connection with every child in the class. Suddenly, I've got this kind of ego connection with that child, and the whole class goes into total disruption. I've lost the story, I've lost the class, so what do I do? I say, everybody put your heads on your desk. You are so bad. You are so naughty. I blame them, of course. Of course. So what we have to do out of anthroposophy is understand that we can actually be in three or four places at once. I can turn my back to the class, and I can, in form drawing, you know, make a straight line slowly and not lose the class. Sherry, please turn this way. I want you to see the whole line. Rick, remember, crayons are not in your hands yet. They're still on your desk. Okay? Sherry and Rick, thank you for being so helpful and cooperative. So, to have eyes in back of your heads, that what I'm doing here is a physical activity. My etheric body is also active in holding that form. Astrally, my astral body is moving around the class. It doesn't need eyes or ears or anything. It's a breathing experience. I'm breathing with those children. And now and then that flashing up of the ego activity, one might say, where I get a sense for how this is going to affect the child's future or what I have to do tomorrow differently to meet that child in a different way. That will come. And there again, that has no relationship to space or to time whatsoever. We could say that the etheric body functions and is moving into the child, ages 7, 8, 9, where the etheric body is up to 5th grade, still incarnating at the speed of sound. I hope Ron accepts this. That the astral body, which has much further to move, the etheric body is basically coming to the child from the moon and becoming one, mostly one, 95%, with their physical body by 5th grade, 750 miles an hour, Mach 1. The astral body, which has to move from the far distances of the solar system, from Saturn to the child, takes longer. Not until about age 14, 12 to 14, does the astral body find its 50% relationship to the physical body, because we're always breathing it in and out. That moves at the speed of light. The ego, which doesn't really come to us, what little bit comes at all, until we're in our early 20s, 19 to 22, 23, that moves faster than the speed of light, we might say. Well, you might say there's no such thing, but now and then scientists claim something's moved faster than the speed of light. That's still an open question, back to the Einsteinian physics and so on. So these different speeds make it possible for us to be functioning on 4 different levels as we move in a more phlegmatic, predictable way, the verses, eating, the snacks and all of that. The etheric body is very stimulated, very engaged. Same story for 3 days in a row, or at least the review, which also stimulates etheric forces. The astral body is where unpredictable things come, where there's sudden laughter, where there's great sorrow, where children are being moved somewhat in their emotions, but the teacher is like a conductor, making sure those emotions really are harmonized in the class as a whole. And the ego, we can't predict. You know, whence it goeth, whither it comest, that's really a mystery for us. But now and then there's that flashing up as well. So this is something that we are given as teachers, this kind of threefolding, this fourfold quality of working on many levels with the class. And this is something then in our evening rickshaw exercise, when we look back on what transpired in the day and we see ourselves in the midst of the children, we sort of see ourselves from another dimension. It's as though our angel is looking down on those experiences. And we get to experience what the angel sees every night as we sleep. Further on, every night when we fall asleep, we join our class. Only they're not children anymore, and we're not an adult. We're all spiritual beings, as it were. We're all equal. And we gather together with the children's angels, with the archangel of the class, we might say. And there we go over our lesson plan. We go over what we did the day before, and we go over what we're going to do. We're in school all day, and then we're in school all night. No wonder Waldorf schools are such physical wrecks. You know, it's a lot, it's a whole lot. But that's healing, that heals the day. That's the therapeutic aspect for the teacher as well. So I plan a lesson. I want to talk about Queen Elizabeth, let's say. It's grade seven or perhaps 8, learning about English history. And I have all kinds of facts to give the children, and I'm only going to get to a few of them. And I'm talking about the British Navy And somebody raises, a child raises her hand. I say, not now. It's important. Not right now. I'm speaking. Please. What is it? Wasn't there somebody named Sir Walter Raleigh? And I don't know, didn't he? Yes, boys and girls. So Sir Walter Raleigh, a privateer, had a great deal to do with the development of the British. Where did she get that from? The children also have the responsibility of keeping me on track in what I'm going to teach. And if I forget to say something, they may have to remind me. Or they may have to respond to something I'm saying in such a way that I realize they want to hear more about this and less about that. But I have to be out there, as it were, with, you know, astral networking, the real internet in a certain respect, constantly communing with those children, constantly making a relationship with those children. And that relationship then will go into their relationship with what they're learning. They have to make a relationship to the content. I have to make a relationship to them. They have to make a relationship to what I've studied, the 8 hours of preparation I've done for the 1 hour of content they're going to get. And I have to make a relationship to that content myself to know what fits them and what isn't that important, to really distinguish the essential from the non-essential. Now, Sherry mentioned I have online conferences for teachers. The total content of those 8 grades of conferences is 370 hours, and still counting. I'm still adding more to it. And that is just giving teachers the bare bones of what they need to be able to teach the various grades. The 8th grade conference, I learned just the other day, is almost as long as all 8 seasons of Game of Thrones. So, and you have to listen to it in 2 weeks. Talk about binge stuff. So that's what Waldorf is about. I mean, the content per se is immense. And I don't hold back on that because I don't want to give the teachers, well, you can just teach this on Monday and on Tuesday, just skip all that stuff. And you don't really have to do Chaldea, however you pronounce it. I never taught it myself. So, you know, it's rather giving them much more than they can ever teach and letting them work through that themselves. Make it, do it yourself. So here we have a school method that depends on the teacher's belief, faith, that every night while they are sound asleep, they are communing with their students, they are working together, that no, you should not figure out what you're going to teach that morning. You should do it the evening before. In fact, I try to present it as a set of maps. There's a globe of the earth, right? You look at that globe and it doesn't seem to change that much over, let's say, every millennial or double millennial period. It's not going to look that different. A volcanic island here will disappear, another one will rise up. But basically, it looks pretty much the same, okay? Then you have political maps where you see the borders of countries. They're usually flat. Sometimes they're globes. The names of countries. Every 10, 20 years, those change, sometimes drastically, like when the British colonial period ended and countries were breaking off and renaming themselves, like when the wall came down in Berlin and suddenly all of Eastern Europe was renamed all over the place. So that changes more rapidly. And then you have roadmaps, or today you have GPS. So you're being told minute by minute, watch out, there's a bridge down there. Take the following detour. You will save 3 minutes. Go that way. An accident's been reported. Let me give you a choice of 3 different routes. Like that, in the moment, okay? Anthroposophy, the study of anthroposophy, the work of self-development, that's the globe. There, Steiner gives us pictures of childhood, of human development, of evolution that have a kind of universal quality that are going to remain true for thousands of years. Then you have the Waldorf curriculum and the preparation that you do in the summer, let's say, or what you do in the weekend before you start a block, where you work out the big picture, knowing that not everything's going to work out exactly this way, but you've made it your own. You've changed the curriculum slightly. That's like a political map, we might say. And where's the GPS? Where's the roadmap? You close the door of the classroom and you stand before the children. If only I had that voice. Watch out, John is about to throw a piece of clay. be careful, Eugene. Detour. Don't talk about that right now. They're not interested. You have to sort of have that inner GPS, that inner Siri or Alexa guiding you. And that is, as it were, your own angel, your own archangel, perhaps, making the connection with the children, which is as accurate a guide as you might possibly get. So it works on these different levels, and one has to be, sometimes you're drawing on the globe. You need to look at the globe to figure out what your orientation is. Sometimes the political map, sometimes the GPS, sometimes all three at the same moment. So it calls on us to be flexible, to be individuals who are really able then to make anthroposophy work and make ourselves and our own teaching a work in progress.